It is Monday, November the 23rd. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, multiple arrests in Brussels and the chief Paris suspect remains at large. Also ahead, Ron is vague on the sentencing of an American journalist to prison.
Apparently, they are just leaving this ambiguous so that maybe that Americans will ask them and discuss this matter with them, which is not part of this nuclear pact.
Plus, the latest on the massacre in Mali. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Good to have you with us today. Belgian prosecutors say police in Brussels arrested 16 suspects. It happened in terror raids on Sunday. There was no word on Paris suspect Salah Abdeslam, who is thought to have crossed into Belgium November 14th, the day after the Paris massacre. Speaking early today in Brussels, prosecutors said at least one suspect was wounded during the raids at numerous locations in and around the capital, a city set to remain in lockdown as authorities hunt suspects in those Paris killings. Belgian prosecutor Eric van der Sip.
During a search in a snack bar in the Sint-Jans Molenbeek, a vehicle ran into the police, after which the police officers fired two shots. The vehicle rushed off but was intercepted later in Brussels. The driver, a man who was hurt, was arrested. For the time being, we cannot confirm if there is a relation between the ongoing investigation and this arrest. No further specific incidents occurred during the searches. No further information can be given about the objects found, nor about the identity of the persons arrested. Until now, no firearms or explosives were found. Salah Abdeslam is not among the persons arrested during the searches. Specific elements of the inquiry necessitated the operation of Sunday night. The investigation continues. In the interest of the further inquiry, currently no more details can be given. The Federal Prosecutor's Office and the police services insist on thanking the press and the users of the social media for having taken into account the needs of the ongoing operation when covering the operation.
Speaking on Sunday, just before departing the ASEAN summit in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, President Obama said the news media can play a vital role in the pursuit of the Islamic State militants.
One of the things that has to happen is how we report on this has to maintain perspective and not empower in any way these terrorist organizations or elevate them in ways that make it easier for them to recruit or make them stronger.
Mr. Obama was emphatic about this pursuit of the Islamic State militants. He said they will be defeated because Americans and others like them are better and stronger than the terrorists and their deadly agenda.
They're a bunch of killers with good social media, and they are dangerous, and they've caused great hardship to people. But the overwhelming majority of people who go about their business every day, the Americans who are building things and making things and teaching and saving lives as firefighters and as police officers, and they're stronger. Our way of life is stronger. We have more to offer. We represent 99.9% of humanity, and that's why we should be confident that we'll win.
U.S. Congressman Andre Carson, a Democrat from the state of Indiana and member of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, speaks with VOA's Carol Castiel, who asked him what his recommendation would be to the Obama administration and to his fellow lawmakers about dealing with the threat from the Islamic State.
Well, I think the White House is quite aware of this imminent threat. I think the cooperation between the administration and Congress has run rather smoothly. The larger question for the intelligence community and law enforcement community is, how can we exchange information and work cooperatively in a way that will isolate the threat and contain the threat and ultimately allow the threat to be eliminated? And that will take some time. We're dealing with a threat in tangible form. But in the abstract, we're talking about a philosophy, a destructive ideology, an undercurrent of manipulation that is capitalizing on disillusionment, discontent, joblessness, and, quite frankly, a sense of hopelessness as it relates to some of those folks who are attracted to the ISIL movement.
Well, that's a very good point, because a military strategy is certainly not nearly enough. And many analysts are saying that unless the world addresses some of the grievances in the region by the Sunni population, in particular in Syria and even in Iraq, that, you know, we will not be able to defeat ISIS. What are your thoughts with respect to other strategies, political and others, to really address the root of the problem?
The administration is attempting the countering violent extremism strategy, which has been quite controversial in the States. Other nations are implementing their own version of CVE. I think what has to happen is that we have to get to root causes of these problems. First and foremost, we're talking about great sense of despair across the region, the Middle East and in Europe. We're talking about growing xenophobia as it relates to Muslims who have migrated over the past few decades into European countries. We're talking about folks who are misusing and misrepresenting the religion of Islam for their own vain purposes. And when you have an uneducated society that does not attempt to study the religion for themselves, you open yourselves up to what we saw in the 60s and 70s with the rise of so-called cult movements, or as sociologists like to refer to them, as new religious movements, where you have these organizations and these so-called charismatic figures who are manipulating emotions, they're manipulating our natural human sense and desire to belong to a movement, to belong to an organization, to belong to a greater purpose, as it were. And I think we're seeing the same kinds of methodologies being implemented with ISIL. Unfortunately, it is a paramilitary organization with the trappings of a state. It is not a state. They don't have city managers, town managers, anyone who could run a grid, thankfully. And it seems as if, at this point, they don't necessarily have a centralized command where they can launch strikes. And so the challenge that we're facing right now within the intel community is how can we open the lines of communication in terms of intelligence sharing without compromising greater information that could absolutely be beneficial to apprehending some of these perpetrators of these serious crimes.
U.S. Congressman Andre Carson is a Democrat in the state of Indiana. He's also a member of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, and he was speaking with my colleague Carol Castiel, who is host of the BOA program Press Conference USA. You can hear more of their conversation, which also included the U.S. Ambassador to Iraq and Turkey, James Jeffrey, at our website, voanews.com. Look for Press Conference USA under the Programs tab. Iran has sentenced Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian to an unspecified prison term following his conviction last month on espionage charges. The U.S. State Department called on Iran to vacate the sentence and immediately free Rezaian. It also said Tehran should free two other Americans it's holding. For some perspective on all of this, International Edition's Victor Beatty speaks with Alam Payan. He is director of the Middle East Studies Center at Ohio State University.
It's a very serious case, because the way that I know, it's almost about 488 days, maybe more than that. So he is in prison somehow. But there is one thing that the representative of the Iranian judiciary, or the spokesperson, his name is Hussein Mohsini. He has mentioned that, did not mention the period that he will be imprisoned, whether those 488 days will be counted or not. And also he has mentioned that it is not finalized. So I do not know. Apparently they are just leaving this ambiguous so that maybe that Americans will ask them and discuss this matter with them, which is not part of this nuclear pact, because there are two tracks. The nuclear pact is a separate thing, and also this, the situation of Jason Rezaian is a different one. So somehow the Iranians are looking for ways that Americans may ask them that they get some sort of, what do you call, concessions, which Americans are not ready to accept, because they keep these two things separate from each other, the nuclear pact and the Rezaian case. It's not only Rezaian. There are two other Americans, too. So there are three of them. But the important thing is that now this the presidential election in these campaigns, probably the other contenders from the Republican Party will make a big issue out of this. So we do not know what will be the consequences of all these internal politics in the United States, and also the other five members of the, what do you call, the world's big powers that were negotiating this nuclear deal with Iran.
I want to ask you about that nuclear deal. Any impact on the implementation of this deal with this situation going on? Obviously, it shows Iran is going to pursue its own interests.
Yes, Iran is, they have, Iranians are very difficult to negotiate with. Everyone knows that. So they will drag their feet. And finally, well, everyone knows. Iranians know that this guy is not, this Jason Rezaian is not a spy. There is sort of Trump charges. And his brother clearly mentioned that they do not have much evidence that he has really was spying. He was a journalist, and I think it is known fact among the journalists. He's a respected journalist. But I do not know that what Iranians will make out of this. But I think there is the Iranian, also the Iranian government for the domestic consumption. They want to be to present themselves as tough as the Iranian right-wing Iranians are the supporters of the Ayatollahs in Iran would expect them. So there is this domestic politics in both the United States and Iran sometimes work in some sort of, they diverge from each other. So there is not that much, I would say, consensus on both sides to agree with each other. So Iranians will probably continue to use them as pawns for further negotiations and getting some more concessions from Americans.
The U.S.-based Committee to Protect Journalists said 30 journalists were behind bars in Iran last year, making it the second-worst jailer of reporters after China.
Yes, that's true. That's true because Iran is a state. It is not a chaotic situation in Iran as it is in Iraq or Syria. So if you look at those countries that which are regarded as a non-failed states, so Iran is one of those countries which has a very large number of people in prison and on different charges. It is true that Iran has people behind the bars, probably more than many other countries, including Pakistan and Turkey and Egypt. So Iran, it is true that Iran is probably either the second or the third country in terms of having people from different countries with different passports under some charges behind the bars.
Alan Payan is director of the Middle East Studies Center at Ohio State University. He was speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. For more on the Rezaian case, you can check out our website at voanews.com. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. A leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. And now news from the African continent. Malian authorities searched Sunday for at least three suspects they believe are connected to Friday's deadly jihadist attack on the Radisson Blue Hotel in the capital Bamako that killed 19 people. Investigators are said to be following several leads in the case and have recovered evidence in the hotel from the more than 7-hour siege. A representative from Northern Mali, the separatist group, said the assault on the hotel was an attempt to derail its fragile peace accord signed in June with the Bamako government. The hotel where the attack occurred was preparing to host the latest meeting on implementing that pact. Two West Africa militant groups, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, and an affiliate claim joint responsibility for the attack. A U.S. defense official called AQIM the leading suspect in the assault. And Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, has declared a state of emergency and mourning, days of mourning, starting today in the West African nation. At least eight Al-Shabaab militants were killed in suspected drone strike near a base in Baladul Amin village, which is 120 kilometers north of Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. According to sources who spoke to VOA, at least three senior Al-Shabaab commanders are among the dead. Residents said they heard three big explosions when the airstrikes targeted the Al-Shabaab base early on Sunday. Residents also say they believe the strikes were carried out by a U.S. drone, but there has been no confirmation yet from the Pentagon. And sources have told VOA that a top Al-Shabaab official believed to be the leader of a pro-Islamic State faction has been shot dead in an ambush in southern Somalia. Sheikh Hussein Abdi Gedi and four others were ambushed Sunday by Al-Shabaab fighters near Gudodli village in Middle Juba region. Gedi is the group's deputy governor of the Juba region until recently, when he reportedly left the Al-Qaeda-linked group and attempted to persuade Al-Shabaab fighters to support the IS group in Iraq and Syria. It's the third attack by Al-Shabaab fighters against the fighters thought to be supporters of the Islamic State. According to police in Burundi, at least four people were killed in overnight violence Saturday into Sunday in the capital, Bujumbura. Sporadic shootings and loud explosions punctuated the night as the country grapples with political violence related to the controversial third term of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Hundreds have been killed and tens of thousands have fled Burundi since Mr. Nkurunziza announced his intention to run for a third term. He did that back in April. The new UN envoy to Libya has urged the warring factions there to finally agree to a previously negotiated national unity government. Martin Kobler, who took over last week from Spanish diplomat Bernardino León, met over the weekend with officials of Libya's two rival administrations.
My messages were very clear. We have to progress quickly for the benefit of the people of Libya. I do not want to open the agreement as it stands now. The text should not be changed. If there are things which are not yet resolved, we can discuss about it. But we should go for a rapid signature of the agreement now on the basis where Bernardino León left the process.
The agreement proposes a unity government led by a presidential council, including a prime minister, five deputy prime ministers, and three senior ministers. The internationally recognized government in the East would be the main legislature alongside a state council that would include members of the Tripoli-based General National Congress. Both governments have yet to vote on the deal. And a rare northern white rhino, one of only four known to exist, has died. The San Diego Zoo in the U.S. state of California, 41-year-old female had been suffering from a number of ailments, including a bacterial infection. 1,800-kilogram animal known as Nola took a turn for the worse following surgery for a pelvic abscess. The white rhino was declared extinct in 2008 because of poaching. Only three, all of them in Kenya, are left. And it's time now to check out what's trending online, and it looks like a new feature from Facebook is big. It's trying to help the brokenhearted, as a matter of fact. Our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is here with the gist on the new Facebook tool. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. It has to do with the way you interact with your ex. So it could be an ex-boyfriend, ex-girlfriend, ex-husband, ex-wife, you name it. The new set of tools provides users an option to see fewer posts from these people without having to block or unfriend them. It was test launched Thursday.
Okay, so if you wanted to stay friends with them on Facebook, you could do that without being too involved, couldn't you?
Exactly. Although some people do unfriend or block their exes on social media completely, others find it to be in poor taste. Also, the new feature could be a good way to wean off their presence in your life. Old habits die hard, and drastic changes are sometimes difficult to get used to.
I can see that. How much attention is it getting on social media?
Quite a lot. Many media outlets are writing about the change, and on social media, Time, Mashable, The Guardian, and The Huffington Post have shared article links on Facebook and Twitter.
I'm sure that's generating some heated debate. Tell us an example.
Sure. Under Mashable's Facebook post, this comment got the most number of likes. Why don't we all take a break from Facebook? It's turning society into degenerates. More than 100 people liked that comment. Another user wrote, why have a tool for your exes? Either unfriend them, block them, or unfollow them. How hard can it be? Why torment yourself by having Facebook show you less of their posts? Ridiculous.
I understand, G. So where can we find more information on this change?
There is a blog post on Facebook's press page at newsroom.fb.com. It's titled, Improving the Experience When Relationships End. Steve, speaking of hardships, many people find cat photos and videos to be quite soothing and comforting. And the best hashtag to use this week to find these on Twitter is hashtag Brussels Lockdown.
Not the most intuitive hashtag, is it? Well, what's the story behind it?
The Belgian authorities have requested media and the public to refrain from disseminating any specific information about their counter-terrorism raids. They also asked all citizens to stay calm and to follow strictly the instructions of the police. And the public's response, of course, is to tweet photos of cute cats instead with hashtag Brussels Lockdown.
And
back to you.
You see a whole lot of those photos there, too, don't you? Hey, listen, thanks, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. If you'd like to follow G on Twitter, you're there, yes. Indeed, her handle is at G. Abby Lee. And you can also find International Edition on Twitter. We're at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Well, you've decided to cook up that piece of meat you bought a few days ago, but you wonder if it's spoiled. Many of us use the old sniff test. If the meat smells kind of funny, we become concerned. But commercial food suppliers who supply tons of meat to consumers need more than that sniff test to determine if the meat they're about to ship is good. Scientists writing in the American Chemical Society Journal say that they've come up with a new portable and simple system to determine whether meat is safe to eat. Using extremely fluorescent and hollow nanotubes, this newly developed system detects the compounds that are emitted as meat decomposes. The compounds cause the bright fluorescent nanotubes to dim. The researchers exposed their device to meat that sat in a refrigerator for a couple of days and found that more than a 10% decrease in the tube's glow meant that the meat is spoiled. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. You know, Billboard magazine has entered a long-standing debate about releasing its list of top 10 rappers of all time. It turns out that International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Lounge host, Soul Lounge host, that Shauna Renee about this list, which includes some predictable names, but is missing some that people think should be there.
Let's start off with who's on the list. And then we'll talk about who's not.
Okay. Well, these are the top 10 greatest MCs of all time. And I think it's important to mention, because Billboard thought it was important to mention, that we're not talking about entertainers. We're not talking about lyricists. We're talking about MCs, the flow, as it were. Number 10, Lil Wayne, which is no surprise. A newcomer, well, kind of newcomer to mainstream America. Kendrick Lamar came in at number 9. Ghostface Killer, who is from the Wu-Tang Clan, came in at number 8. The only woman on the list, Lauryn Hill, came in at 7. Andre 3000, who happens to be one of my favorites, came in at number 6. 5, Nas. Number 4, Rakim. 3, my homeboy from Detroit, Eminem. And number 2, Jay-Z. No surprise here, the number 1 spot held by the notorious B.I.G.
A.K.A. Biggie Smalls.
Biggie Smalls, yes.
And one name that is missing, Tupac.
Now, that is, I think, the thing that has most people confused and I could say upset. In fact, Snoop has been very vocal about his displeasure, not because he's not on the list, because he is not on the list, but because he worked with Tupac for a few years while they were both in California. And he said he thinks Tupac deserves to be on the list. Billboard contends that Tupac was a phenomenal lyricist. He was a great writer, but he was not one of the greatest MCs, flowists, if you will, of all times. And so he did not make the list. Kanye West didn't make the list. Again, a great writer, wonderful entertainer. Who else? Drake didn't make the list.
Dr. Dre, I was kind of surprised.
Dr. Dre, not so surprised about Dr. Dre. Dr. Dre has never been known for being an MC. Dr. Dre is known for being a producer. But yes, Dre did not make the list. Drake did not make the list. KRS-One, who is the teacher, one of the founding members, if you will, of hip-hop, didn't make the list. Again, phenomenal lyricist, great writer, great mind. The flow, you know, it was good.
There's people like Ice Cube, Ice-T. They're not on the list either.
I was kind of surprised that Ice Cube didn't make the list. But again, I think that when you look at the list and you think, well, if he's supposed to be on this list, who's not supposed to be on the list? That's a really hard decision to make. And you can't win with these lists. I mean, MTV did a top 50 greatest MCs of all time. And we're still arguing about that list 15 years later. The Source magazine does these lists every 10 years or so, and no one's ever satisfied about it. Hip hop has always been, will always be, incredibly subjective in a sense. It's what you like, and you know what I love, other people might not. It's okay.
Well, you can let us know what you love or what you don't love by sending a tweet to Shauna. She is at VOA Lady DJ. You can also log on to our website, voanews.com.
Yes, indeed. We love it all. Thanks for joining us today. For our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Listen, have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When it comes to the Earth's climate, the definition of normal has changed dramatically over the past 30 years. 19 of the 20 warmest years in recorded history have occurred in the past two decades. And this year, said Secretary of State John Kerry, is on track to be the warmest of all. Speaking at a university in Virginia, Secretary Kerry warned that weather extremes, once considered to be rare, are becoming the norm. And what's more, they are just one facet of global climate change, which is increasingly impacting every aspect of human life, from health care to economic activity to human migration all over the world. Not least of all, climate change presents a challenge to our security. Consider that almost every country with land borders shares some international river basins with its neighbors. If the water starts to disappear and climate change is expected to significantly alter both access to and the availability of fresh water, imagine the tensions that can arise, said Secretary Kerry. The impacts of climate change can exacerbate resource competition, threaten livelihoods, and increase the risk of instability and conflict, especially in places already undergoing economic, political, and social stress. Instability and strife anywhere can be a threat to stability everywhere. It recognizes no borders. And that is why all members of the community of nations must work together to mitigate climate change, said Secretary of State Kerry. And in less than a month, our leaders will have the opportunity to hammer out an effective agreement as they meet at the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Paris, France, said Secretary Kerry. I'm not going to tell you that a global climate agreement is going to be the silver bullet that eliminates the threat posed by climate change. But the truth is, we won't eliminate it without an agreement in Paris, he said. We have a moral responsibility to protect the future of our nation and our world. That is our charge. That is our duty. And for our ship, for our shipmates, all of us, and for the generations that follow in their footsteps, we have to get this right.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.